I'd like to start today by telling you a story. It's about when greater things dress themselves up as lesser ones. The text is from the Confucian scholar Dong Zhanchu. He lived during the Han Dynasty, which was a crucial historical turning point for Confucianism. It was during that time that the philosophy became the official teaching of the empire. It received that honor in 136 before the Common Era and would retain that position for two millennia until 1905. Zhanchu's manual, Exuberant Dew of the Spring and Autumn, gives counsel on a wide array of matters from a Confucian perspective. Now, in the eighth chapter of his book, Zhanchu tells the story of a king and his advisor. He was, again, writing before the Common Era, and this story was considered ancient even then. So it's old. But the story is a captivating one. A king is thrust into battle with his enemies. He is being ambushed, and it is highly likely that he will be slaughtered with his armies. And so he hatches a plan with his advisor. The two men look an awful lot alike. So the king takes on the advisor's clothing, and the advisor adorns himself as the king. As the armies press in, they quickly find the man dressed as a king and dispatch him. But in the ensuing chaos, other people in the court who are dressed like civilians are able to escape. The king, dressed as his advisor, is able to do so. And after the battle is over, the king returns to power. Now, what is so intriguing about this chapter is Zhanchu's unexpected interpretation of it. One might expect that the advisor would be praised for his ingenuity and courage and selflessness in suggesting this plan, but that is not the case. Instead, Zhanchu claims that the king, disguising himself as a civilian and fleeing, is a degradation to the office. Honor should have required him to accept his fate. Another philosopher, in commenting on this passage, quotes the famous Confucian proverb that one should rather be a shattered vessel of jade than an unbroken piece of pottery. In other words, the king should have accepted his fate with dignity, not stooping to dress himself as something he is not. The view is extreme. And we live in a time when we are thankfully quite removed from royalist thinking, except perhaps when we are watching The Crown or talking about Harry and Meghan on social media. I think it's called Megxit, right? Megxit? So I find it difficult to enter the mindset of Zhanchu. It's hard to accept such an elevated notion of honor. But I am going to suggest today that there just might be some kernel here, some lesson for us 21st century citizens of a democracy. The lesson is that in certain instances, when one thing is dressed up like another, its value just may be lost or degraded. I'll return to that in a bit. In the meantime, I want to talk about one of my favorite political philosophers. Her name is Wendy Brown. She teaches political science at UC Berkeley. I got to sit in on a lecture of hers while I was studying for my doctorate, and she's made a great impact on my own social and political thinking. In her book, Undoing the Demos, she argues that ideals of democratic participation and citizenship have been deformed. Here is a quote. In a century heavy with political ironies, there may have been none greater than this, that at the end of the Cold War, as mainstream pundits hailed democracy's global triumph, new forms of reasoning have inaugurated democracy's conceptual unmooring and substantive disembowelment. Within 30 years of the fall of the Berlin Wall, Western democracy would grow gaunt, ghostly, its future increasingly hedged and improbable. Her book thus records the ways in which our democratic legacy is slowly losing its shape and force, becoming something other than itself. Now, in Brown's estimation, this is partly because forms of economic reason have overtaken the democratic sphere. It has happened to both parties, in fact. She begins by quoting one recent Democratic president who said this: "A growing economy that creates good middle-class jobs must be the North Star that guides our efforts. The only three questions that matter today are these: how do we attract more jobs to our shores? How do we equip our people with the skills needed to do those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living?" Now, no one would argue, I don't think, that those are crucial questions, because they are. They are ones that we should absolutely be asking ourselves. But what Wendy Brown takes issue with are the subtle implications in the turn of rhetoric. This seems to imply that the only important questions to be asking ourselves are about economic growth. And this is problematic, I would suggest, because as important as the economy is, it is not everything in a democracy. There are other questions that are crucial. These entail what we are to do with human rights, how we are to remedy social institutions that have been deformed by racism and sexism, what sort of actor we wish to be on the international stage, and what we consider to be a fair or just way to engage our environment, as well as so many other questions. When we reduce it all to job creation, there are indeed troubling implications and things that get left out. Now, one of our Republican presidents has taken that reasoning and stated it in an even starker way. When he ran, he asserted that he would like to run the country like a business. But again, this has troubling implications. And that's because corporations, businesses, are organized and obligated to increase shareholder interests. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. That simply constitutes their legal definition. But that also means that they are not necessarily focused on or organized to protect people who are vulnerable. They are not set up to worry themselves over human rights. In a corporation, people who do not or cannot contribute to its bottom line are cut, and they are made to fend for themselves. And that may work just fine in a corporation, but it is a chilling thing to imagine for a democratic society, when we begin to imagine our democracy as a corporation. Again, there are troubling consequences that result. If democracy is a corporation and you find yourself cut out of its economic operations because of outsourcing or downsizing or factory closings, then there may be little or no recourse for you. Now, the Harvard social theorist Amartya Sen, in his article "Democracy as a Universal Value," put it another way. He says that democracy is crucial because it allows us to negotiate economic concerns rather than being negotiated by them. He writes, "Democracy has an important instrumental value in enhancing the hearing that people get in expressing and supporting their claims to political attention, including claims of economic needs. And when that starts to break down, when democratic remedies disappear, people are left without the tools to state their needs and to be seen in the public sphere. Their suffering becomes private, silent, something that has no space in which to be addressed. Markets are not able to fill those gaps because markets are not designed to give voice to those without resources to access the markets. This is the great gift of democracy, that even with all of its imperfections, it gives us a space for the rich diversity of individuals from all classes and backgrounds to appear with our needs and positions and to debate how best to approach social issues. But this function of democracy is precisely what has become increasingly hedged and improbable. Part of this has to do with recent legal decisions, which again seem to merge democratic and economic interests. The Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court effectively recast the use of money as free speech. And this has made it possible for corporations to pour millions into a single election, all under the guise of First Amendment protections. There should be nothing surprising about the results. Where citizens of a democracy, precisely the citizens who most need redress in the public sphere, are crowded out of politics by super-rich corporate interests. Basically, if you do not have hundreds of millions to spend on campaigns, your voice matters that much less. Here, democratic concerns come to wear the garb of economic interests, and the ideals of civic equality are degraded. Now, some would say, fine, that's just fine, because what's really important is whether or not there are jobs. And as long as those jobs are being created, then so what if democratic considerations are demoted? In fact, some might point out that the economy in recent years, against what many pundits predicted, is doing quite well. Unemployment has even decreased. But I would nonetheless challenge that line of thinking. Because those who are still in poverty, those who are struggling with food insecurity and lack of health care and inadequate shelter, are worse off today than they were 30 years ago. There are even fewer resources available to them. Minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation, and those at the bottom of the economic ladder have seen their standard of living decrease steadily over the last decades. Some sociologists are writing about these decreased standards of living as contributing in no small way to what they are calling diseases of despair, where growing numbers of people are turning to opioids, alcohol, and even suicide. Now, a rabbi from long ago said that a society should be judged by how it treats those who are least well off. And I would argue that, in part because of the decay of democratic practices that should provide us with a way of correcting our course of action, we are not doing so well on that count. Now, I can imagine someone hearing this and thinking, Lucas, you sound like you are running for president. And I am here today to announce. No, totally kidding on that. I couldn't think of something I less want to do. But in all seriousness, someone might well be listening and thinking, what does this have to do with church? This is about politics. It's not about church. So let me tell you what I think it has to do with church. The fifth principle of Unitarian Universalism affirms the use of the democratic process in our congregations and in society at large. And that is not some quirk of the authors of the seven principles. Unitarian Universalism, from its origins in the Reformation, has held democracy as a value. It holds that the spark of divinity in each individual conscience, that the worth and dignity of each person can only be meaningfully asserted when people have a say and a vote in what matters to them. Now, that is not about any particular candidate or partisan position. It is instead about democracy as a value in itself. It is saying that to the extent that democracy is diminished, so too is the worth and dignity of each person's life. And so I think that this is our task this year as Unitarian Universalists. It's to do what we can to reinvigorate our democracy. And I'm glad to say that we'll hear a little bit more about how we might approach that in just a little bit. But I'll end by saying this. Democracy is a precious and fragile thing. Its gifts can easily be lost or squandered, annulled by other concerns. When we allow it to be dressed as something it is not, we just might risk losing something irreplaceable. At least for today, it's still in our hands not to lose it. My spiritual companions, amen. I love you, and blessed be.